The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters.
Hi, and welcome to The Hearing. I am Tanae Frazier, your host for this week's episode. And today, I spoke to Professor Luke Schaefer. Professor Schaefer is the professor of social justice and social policy. He's also the professor of public policy and the director of poverty at the University of Michigan. He has co-authored two books, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America, and his recent book, The Injustice of Place, Uncovering the Legacy of Poverty in America. His books and poverty were the topic of our conversation. And what I learned during this conversation was that over 1.5 million Americans are living on less than $2 a day, and how this type of extreme poverty has an effect on all facets of life, from being able to find affordable or sufficient housing, making a living wage, having access to health care, adequate child care, and also food insecurity. We also discussed the higher costs people living in poverty pay to meet their basic needs, time being one of their biggest expenses. Professor Schaefer's books showcase individuals and families living in these conditions and how they find ways to supplement their income or lack thereof. But what I found most fascinating about his work and his books is how each family's greatest desire was to find a job, make a living wage in order to support themselves and their families. I hope you enjoy this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it.
The Hearing.
Hi, Professor Schaefer. Thank you for joining me today to discuss poverty in America. Luke, you've been heralded as a leading scholar of poverty and social welfare policy. You've co-authored two books, $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America, and The Injustice of Place. But before we get talking about these two books and how poverty is playing a role in America, I want to discuss a little bit about you and how, more so, what your reasoning was for writing this book and what did you seek to prove or disprove?
Tanae, it's great to be with you. Really glad to get the chance to have a conversation. I grew up without a lot of money. My dad had a career crisis when we were in seventh grade, and we went from sort of the bottom rungs of the middle class into poverty, and really struggled, only had a place to live because some family friends rented a place to us for well below what they could have gotten. And I just was really realized, I think, as I was growing up, that we didn't have as much money as the folks around us, but we had grandma and grandpa who could help us out, so we didn't have to go to the welfare office. So I sort of didn't feel like I was poor, but I didn't feel like I was middle class. And so since then, I've sort of wanted to try to dedicate my life to sort of the work of understanding poverty in the United States and seeing what can be done about it. I started out as a caseworker, helping people with their utility bills, helping them pay the rent, helping them with food. And I remember being struck early on that every single month, I could predict with 100% certainty that there would be people in my office who didn't have enough, that were at risk of being evicted or having their utilities shut off. And so that was really when it dawned on me that the big answers couldn't be that people weren't being responsible or that it was a person's fault. If I could be certain that somebody wasn't going to make it every single month in the small town that I was a caseworker, there had to be bigger issues at play. And that's what really got me interested in policy across the spectrum. So social welfare policy, programs like Social Security that really cut elderly poverty, you know, massively as it rolled out and protects a lot of seniors from hardship, lifts a lot of seniors just above that poverty line. So they're still often struggling to pay for medications, but they have that stable amount. Programs like food assistance that reduce food insecurity, but actually indirectly help families with a lot of other things. So, but then lots of different things that you might not expect that, you know, in the city of Detroit, when we started working with Mayor Duggan and his team, thinking about all the things people were telling us as we were asking residents and policymakers, one thing that I never imagined being high on the list of pretty much everybody was the high cost of auto insurance. But when we went back to the data after we started with listening and talking to folks, we saw that the same policy that was pricing out at like $1,200 nationally was about $2,200 a year in Michigan and like $5,400 in the city of Detroit. So that was almost 20% of the income of Detroiters. So this is what's gotten me interested. First in $2 a day, which really tries to match large-scale data and also talking to families and like starting with a place of humility that from whatever our positionalities are, as a lawyer, as a policy nerd like me, we're going to miss things. And so if we start with listening, we can often uncover challenges and ways to actually intervene to make families' lives better that we never expected. And so especially that second book that you mentioned, Injustice of Place, that was a book of surprises from start to finish, from the communities that we ended up focusing on to a lot of the chapters. And so I really find, you know, the longer I do this work, the less I feel like, you know, quote unquote, the national expert, because there's so much to know. And, you know, I just find if I start from a place of humility, it can open my eyes to challenges that I might never have seen otherwise, but also ways that we can intervene in systems to make them work better for families.
So, Luke, going back to $2 a day, you and your team, you all interviewed about 18 families. And what you discovered that there's a misperception among people in America that people that are seeking help or who need help or those in poverty, that they somehow want to be in this state, that they are not wanting to work, that they're not seeking to better themselves. But you found that to be different in your findings. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, that book started with an insight from my co-author, Kathy Eden. So at that stage of my career, I was really a quantitative researcher. I spent a lot of time, you know, looking at data in my office and trying to find out how to help make these programs work better for families and for the public. And she would, you know, when she had a question, she would actually go out and talk to people, which is getting more common in the academy and social science, but was very uncommon then. It's still kind of uncommon. And so she had met families who were surviving on like no cash income at all. So they might have food assistance. Sometimes they would have like a housing subsidy, although those are actually quite rare. When we were working in the city of Chicago, the wait list to get a housing subsidy was 85,000 people long, and it was closed. It was closed, so you couldn't even be 85,001 if you wanted. But some families do have a housing subsidy. But what families were really lacking was money to pay the utility bill or pay for toilet paper or kids' school clothes or whatever all of those things are, toothbrushes, you know, things that the food assistance that we offer doesn't provide. And so families had to do all sorts of things, some legal and some illegal. When you think about like the way our systems put families into sort of situations where all of their choices are bad. So when Kathy sort of mentioned to me that in her work on other things, she was seeing more and more families like this. This is one of those examples where we didn't go in looking for this. We went back to all the large-scale data we had, and what we found was this huge increase in families reporting very low levels of cash income that started in the late 1990s, around the time that Bill Clinton signed the welfare law. And that law, we thought, created a work-first, time-limited welfare program, but what it really did was create an incredibly flexible funding stream that states could use to provide cash assistance to poor families, which is, you know, not a popular thing to do. Or they could say that some other thing that they were probably already doing, fit one of the core purposes of the block grant, and then use the TANF money, which was supposed to go to cash aid for those things, and then shift the state money to something else. And so it kind of became a little bit of a shell game, and a lot of states have seen the amount of money that provides aid through this really massively decline over the years as states figured out they could balance their budget. So this was not at all what anyone, I think, intended in 1996 when that law was put into effect. But policymakers from Paul Ryan to Barack Obama have all said, you know what, this is not the way this program should work. But as we got to know families, we found exactly what you were saying. You know, we sort of imagined deep poverty, extreme poverty, families who didn't work. And there were a few people in our sample who fit that profile. Actually, the families in very rural communities where jobs are incredibly scarce. But what we saw far more was actually families who were working. You can see this all over the data, that the typical child in extreme poverty, but just regular old poverty, works in a family where somebody is working. But because of the instability in the jobs that are available to them, sometimes the instability in their family lives, and then the instability in housing, quite honestly, every single, you know, one of these members of the sample who are working spiraled into a spell of extreme poverty as they lost their job. And so it was really a dynamic state. And just as you say, we were really interested. We would ask this question, if we came back in a year and you were doing better, what would it look like? And to a person, they would all say, I would have a job. I would have a stable job with stable hours. That was sort of number one. It would pay, you know, $10 to $12 an hour. This was back in like 2013, 2014, when we were doing our field work. And I would have a place of my own to call home. And that was their version of the American dream. And that's what the families that we got to know were really seeking and looking for.
So when you say that they would say that they were had a stable job, they were making $10 to $12 an hour. What I found in your book is that a lot of times they were employed at a low wage job and there was no way for them to sustain a living that way. Definitely not to sustain housing. And so what impact were these low wage jobs playing in their ability to get above the poverty line and to actually start doing better?
That's exactly right. So the sort of vision I was describing is what they wanted and what they could never attain. And a lot of it had to do with the low wage labor market. So you had low wages, and that was a piece of the puzzle. That's sort of like the word we use. But the instability is much deeper than that. So most of these are service sector jobs. And I think we've seen some improvements on this, but it's still incredibly common for, you know, the number of hours, if you worked at a retail establishment or a fast food restaurant, your number of hours from week to week might fluctuate. So we had, you know, somebody like Travis Compton, who we met in Johnson City, Tennessee, who was working at a fast food restaurant, and he was still, quote unquote, employed, but his hours had fallen to zero. And he was not making any money. And so the only money coming into the household when we got to know them was money that Jessica, his wife, made selling her blood plasma, which was a very common survival strategy, which I knew nothing about when we went into this. And in fact, you know, we were some of the first people to write about the massive number of families who sell their blood plasma. So then you have a labor law violation. So you have a story like Jennifer Hernandez, who's working in, you know, in some stores, actually getting overtime hours. It's fairly, you know, most families want more hours, but in her case, she was working overtime hours and not getting paid for the time and a half that she should have been. She ended up losing that job, and then she was working for a a cleaning company that was cleaning foreclosed homes. So she would go into these homes that were boarded up. There's no lights. They're incredibly dirty. They would have to go down to the, you know, nearest gas station to fill up their buckets with water and then bring them down. And then the water would be dirty again. And she, you know, is working in unsafe and very not clean conditions. And she got incredibly sick. And so she sort of spiraled out of that job too. So these types of examples are just, you know, all over the place. If you get to know any person, you know, any set of people working low-wage jobs, this is the type of story that you're going to hear over and over again. And in the labor market, I think sort of depends on it. A lot, you know, being able to reduce the number of hours that you're paying is like, for a lot of these companies, is the only give that they have in their budget. And so that's what leads to a lot of this instability. Or, you know, a very common thing is also to keep people's hours below whatever triggers full-time benefits or full-time hours. So people might be stuck at 29 hours or 34 hours, depending on where that's set. And so this instability is incredibly hard to manage, especially for families with children.
Luke, back to talking about the perilous work and the job conditions. One thing that I read in the book was that Jennifer experienced, I want to say it was Jennifer, she experienced wage theft. So she was working all these hours and they're not paying her for the overtime hours. They're just paying her just singly for her hours that she was working. And that seems to be a common theme, whether they're experiencing wage theft or also they're working in dangerous environments, where in her case, she was working in moldy units and moldy apartments and was picking up respiratory issues and illnesses and then bringing them home to her children. How common is that?
Yeah, well, as you can imagine, it's hard to totally quantify this stuff. But when you look at estimates of how much wage theft there is, it can take lots of different forms. You're talking, you know, on the order of a billion, you know, tons and tons of dollars that are lost. And so you mentioned a couple of the examples of how this happens. We also regularly heard accounts about people who were expected to clock out and then clean their last hotel room. Or maybe it was clean your first hotel room and then clock in, or clock out and then, you know, clean up the big box. You're part of the big box retail store. We hear about sub-minimum wage type wages, you know, that are sort of skirt, those types of rules. So this is one of those places where our enforcement mechanisms are pretty weak on this stuff. And people who are working in the jobs, who need the jobs, who need the money, are pretty reluctant to come forward, as you could imagine, right? They don't want to not get paid for, you know, cleaning that hotel room before they clock in or whatever it might be. But they would rather do that than be unemployed. That's, you know, obviously the decisions that they've made. And they might have very good reason to feel like the enforcement mechanism, you know, if they were to come forward, is not going to help them, right? That they could come forward, that it might end very badly for them. And so you have this sort of space, which I think is a great place for lawyers and the legal community to think about how we do a better job here, where the penalties for this kind of behavior, if you are an employer, are quite low. And if you were to get caught, the chances of you know, a really bad outcome for you as an employer, I think, are also perceived to be quite low. And so the biggest challenge, I think, is that this puts a ton of pressure, not just on the workers, obviously, that's the most important thing, but also the other employers who want to do things by the books, right? If they're suddenly paying people higher wages, they're not as competitive as they would like to be, right? Or at least they, you know, might perceive that in the short run. So it puts a lot of pressure across the board, even on employers that really want to be good actors, you know, not to behave like this. It's almost like a race to the bottom. And so it's one of those places where more work inside the legal community to help families, help workers who are in one of these cycles, better ways to figure out how to do it, maybe better ways to think about how the policies could be realigned in order to make it easier for people to come forward with a concern and to see that through.
The hearing.
As allegiances are tested.
You're gambling with World War III.
And regimes fall.
Fighters and civilians continue to stream in from other parts of Syria.
No matter where the story is, Reuters World News podcast is there. We make sense of the news shaping our world and give you everything you need to know in a 10-minute podcast every weekday. I'm your host, Kim Vanell. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, something else that I want to touch on here deals with the hours that people are working. A lot of these families have children, and when they're working these hours, they're away from their children, and someone else is having to care for their children for long hours, and sometimes the people that are caring for their children may not be the best individuals. Let's talk about some of the abuse that children are experiencing when they have a parent that is working these long hours, not making the minimum wage or not making a living wage, and how that impacts them.
Yeah, when you think about childcare in work hours, the challenges are with the number of hours that, depending on your childcare arrangement, there might be a reasonable expectation that you sort of commit to a certain number of hours and a certain number of days. But if your work schedule shifts from not just the number of hours, so maybe one week you're working 30 hours, the next week you're working 15, and your childcare might, if you have to have the same number of childcare hours, if you have to have 30 childcare hours to fit the bigger week, yeah, you might lose money on that, right? So that becomes a real challenge. So it's a number of hours, but it's also the timing of hours. So a lot of times in shifts, they go across the workday, but then into the evening. And even that is not consistent. So you might have a work schedule that is during the day, Monday, Tuesday, and then Wednesday, Thursday in the evening, or it's on the weekend. And so that really puts families in the kind of bind that you've just mentioned. They're probably not even able to commit or afford center-based care because it's very set. And maybe in circumstances where they do, they probably need other kinds of arrangements that can help close the gap for those evening hours, all right? Or sort of the shifts that go from 3 p.m. in the afternoon to 7 p.m. at night. And so that is really, I think, what puts a lot of families into a bind where they're packaging together different kinds of childcare, and that can be risky. Family can be the most wonderful thing in the world, a grandma, you know, who's flexible, who's caring for the kids, another great adult in their life. But family sometimes can also be a risk, and especially for kiddos who, you know, are going from arrangement to arrangement. If you know, let's say they're in three different arrangements, which would not be all that uncommon, right? If two of them are wonderful, but one of them ends up abusive, that abuse sticks with kids for a long time. And so it's really, I think, this instability and this uncertainty that opens the door for these kinds of risks. The experience of what we call adverse childhood experiences is far more common across the entire population than anybody likes to admit. It's just, you know, the number of people who've had experiences of physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, severe neglect in their background is much higher. And it's just, you know, not something that we talk about. So high income, low income, this isn't an issue just of families who are struggling to make ends meet by any stretch. But families, especially in extreme poverty, find themselves in situations where they're more at risk and have less protections against these types of experiences. And so their risk level is higher. And we know that any one of these experiences, and also sort of the cumulative impact of many of them, can really stick with folks. So, you know, Jennifer Hernandez is an example of this. After she flames out of the jobs that we talked about in Chicago, she moves down to Texas. She moves in with an aunt and an uncle. And the uncle had a full-time job, I think at a golf course. She was like, I'm so glad we're going to be moving in with him because he's, you know, a solidly middle-class person and can be a good role model for my kids. The hardest part of writing $2 a day is the scene where Jennifer walks in on her uncle molesting her daughter, Caitlin. And, she immediately, grabs Caitlin. They leave. There was a wonderful social service agency that took her in. And they get out of the situation, but that sticks with Caitlin. And her family is not supportive of her bringing the attention of this to the authorities. She ends up actually losing some of her family relationships because she thinks that he should pay for what he did. And his family wants to sort of, sweep it under the rug.
That was hard for you to write. It was hard for me to read. It was really tugging at my heartstrings when I read that portion. But some of the other factors that came into play is in housing. A lot of times when someone is dealing with poverty, they don't have sufficient housing, whether it be substandard or they're living in dilapidated housing, or whether they're living in a situation where there's overcrowding, too many people in the home because we're just trying to make it. That was something else that I noticed that you mentioned in the book. So could you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, so I think people are used to thinking of like homelessness as folks on the street, maybe somebody asking for money on the street corner. Homelessness among families really tends to take the form of doubling up, that families, like Jennifer Hernandez, who can't afford a place, are moving in, couch surfing. This type of arrangement tends to be incredibly unstable, that you might be able to stay there for a little while. So we're not really talking about like multi-generational stable families, which I think can be a positive. We're talking about sort of unstable, I just lost my job. I just had a fight with my partner, it got physical and I need to leave. And that kind of instability is incredibly hard, especially on children, where they don't know where they're going to be sleeping from night to night. The sleeping arrangements maybe aren't stable. Maybe they're on a couch where somebody's coming in and out after they've gone to bed. And then it can be unsafe. And just as you said, the final piece of the puzzle we've talked about, unstable jobs, unstable families, and unstable housing is almost like a three-legged stool. Our affordable housing challenges have really... they've been years in the making since I think the 2008 housing crisis. We've been building a lot less housing, and all the incentives are to build big houses. And so we've just been putting more and more pressure on small houses. And the public schools actually, since about the 2010s, have been tracking the number of kids who are unstably housed, and we can see that really increase. Actually, it increases in tandem with our estimates of families experiencing, spells without any cash income. We think the two are directly linked. And you can see in the school records that kids who are unstably housed, that they have the most challenged academic outcomes of any kid, that chronic absenteeism is highest among kiddos that are unstably housed, math proficiency, English proficiency, all of these things really hurt. And that is because whatever community you're in, in my second book, Injustice a Place, we got to know rural communities, and we found that, they have housing problems just like most urban areas. There's a handful of urban areas that the housing is just outrageous. But, you get rid of these three or four cities, After that, rural areas are also incredibly just as challenged in housing, and housing quality is, I think, an even bigger issue in a lot of rural communities, especially southern rural communities.
Yes, I agree. Now, something else that I thought about as well, stem from with these overcrowded homes, comes the children who are experiencing a food insecurity. And some might say, well, how are they experiencing food insecurity? I know that, well, they think that these individuals are receiving some type of food stamp assistance or SNAP benefits. But what you discovered in the book, well, what I discovered in the book was that a lot of times to make up the difference with the cash insufficiency, they're using the food stamps or the SNAP benefits to make that balance or to balance that deficiency. And what happens is now we don't have enough food for everyone to have in the household. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. So it turns out to function in 21st century America, you need a little bit of money. And so families turn to different coping strategies. And one of the ones that is common is selling your food assistance, because that is the benefit that is as common as any that we have. And so this usually takes a form, the most common way to do it is you might go to a small grocery store and you ring through $100 in fake groceries and you get $60 back. And this is like the exchange rate. So I haven't been in the field for a while, so I don't know where the exchange rate is, but it was interesting. You know, no matter where you went, it was about 60 cents on the dollar, except for Mississippi, where it was closer to 50 or even 40 cents. And families do this because they need that flexibility. They need toilet paper, but it does cut into their food aid. We've increased how much food aid we give since that time. That's been a very positive thing. But it can be challenging, even if you use all of the dollars for food, to make it. You know, you see a lot of evidence of people getting to the end of the month and test scores go down, you know, discipline problems at school go up because there's less food coming into the house. Now, that sort of exchange that I mentioned, of course, of like, you know, $60 in cash for $100 in food aid, that's illegal. And actually, usually when you apply for public benefits, most state applications will say at the bottom, if you engage in food stamps trafficking or SNAP trafficking, you could be charged up to $250,000, a fine of $250,000, and face 20 years in prison. So I don't know that anyone's ever been prosecuted to that level, but you know, it speaks to sort of the criminalization of the way like a lot of these systems treat people. Is like that is what you're reading when you're applying for this benefit. So imagine what it might make you feel like if you were applying for this benefit and, you know, you saw this level of sort of criminalization of this thing that people are usually doing, you know, just because they're trying to make ends meet. So I think we wrote in the book that you're actually better off in terms of the penalty you might face, you're better off robbing a bank than selling your food assistance. Now, obviously, we would never condone that, but I think it's, it just speaks to the level with which, you know, anytime you're engaging in a system like this, there's really often seems to be a presumption of guilt rather than a presumption of innocence, or just a lot of signals that we don't trust you and we're watching you.
Something I want to touch on again is in regards to how expensive it is to be poor. They often call it the poverty tax. In one way, when you mentioned earlier, when you began speaking, you talked about insurance rates. That's just only one facet. But it's very expensive to be poor. Whereas in the book, you mentioned that a lot of time people that are living in poverty pay with their time. Can you elaborate on that?
Great question. And we don't sort of have the full extent of what a poverty tax is, again, because you brought up the auto insurance. There's just so many different facets of it. And so just, you know, imagine I live in Ann Arbor. It's a well-off college town. I pay so much less in auto insurance than somebody, a single mom living in Detroit, really anybody living in Detroit. You know, there's all these interesting things where in Michigan, if you have a perfect driving record but bad credit, you actually pay more in auto insurance than somebody who has perfect credit, but, you know, driving while under the influence offense. So there's tons of these different kinds of systems. We're actually at Poverty Solutions, the group that I run at the University of Michigan, we're doing work on home insurance and how a lot of the same things happen there. And usually people will say, you know, oh, well, I can explain why that is. And, you know, there's some logical reason. But the end result is often that poor folks pay more for everything. And in particular, people of color, especially Black Americans, you know, the algorithms or whatever they are tend to mean that Black Americans are face, you know, these types of costs at a greater rate than especially white Americans and the public as a whole. And so, you know, the outcome is one of racial inequality. It's of, you know, income inequality. And I think this is a great time to be thinking about all of the different ways that that could play out. Grocery stores often charge more for things in lower income communities. You know, one thing that comes up is fines and fees. So that's another place where a lot of lawyers could get involved. The cost of fines and fees have really gone up over the years because, you know, states and municipalities haven't wanted to raise other kinds of taxes. And so they raise a fine and fee. For example, driving without auto insurance in Michigan, is the offense is much more expensive than it used to be. And then if you don't pay it, you know, in a lot of places, you get like a ticket on a ticket. It gets bigger and bigger and it balloons, you know, over time. Families who are poor are the most likely to have their children lost to the child welfare system. Usually that's, you know, because of neglect, which means somebody saw your child didn't have a proper coat or something. And so they called you in and then there was an investigation and they found your house was not safe. And so they've taken your child. In a lot of states, you actually get charged for that. Then, you know, the state garnishes your wages. And so, you know, we saw examples where somebody's working at a McDonald's job, but they get their first paycheck and it's, you know, a tiny fraction of what it was supposed to be. So this is really, I think, a place where lawyers could make a really big difference, that they could be looking into these things, thinking about how they could be made more equitable, you know, helping people get their licenses back or getting their criminal records expunged. There's enough work to keep so many people busy, and it matters an immense amount to people.
I think one area that we don't think about as much is in the healthcare industry, whereas a person that is living in poverty is not going to have a primary care doctor. They're going to be going to the hospital for emergency care. They're going to have sustained long-term illnesses, which may be permanent. I think one of the examples, or the families had rotten teeth and at a young age, 24 years old, had lost all of her teeth. So those are some of the areas too that can be cost prohibitive because they don't have any insurance. It's very expensive to go to the doctor, and therefore I don't go to the doctor.
Yeah, so we have done a lot of great things with public health insurance for children and for adults too over time, but the coverage of children is quite good. It goes well up the economic ladder, but dental care is often something that is not well covered. And so that is a huge unmet need. It's a major reason why kids miss school. It's a major reason dental pain, you know, it's a major reason why adults miss work. And there's countries all over the world that have a provider that fills this gap. They're called a mid-level dental provider or a dental therapist, and they can usually do, you know, some of the restorative care that dentists can do, but not like the really, really fancy stuff. And so you know, in New Zealand, they've eradicated untreated tooth decay among children, school-age children, because they have this type of provider in every single school. So that's a kind of like changing the system type approach that I'm talking about, where we can get better results. You can create a good job for someone by training them to work like this. And it's the type of approach that's been now is active in a couple of states in the United States that also crosses party lines. A lot of these last things we've been talking about, they're not just things that Republicans would be interested or Democrats could be interested, but something where we can really make systems work better for families in a bipartisan or collaborative way.
All right. Thank you so much, Luke. I really appreciate you joining us today.
It was so fun talking to you today. And thanks for reading my books. And it was just really great to be in conversation with you.
The Hearing.
I just want to say thank you so much to Luke. I really enjoyed talking to him. I had so many more questions, but just didn't want to pepper him to death. But really enjoyed having this conversation. Hopefully we'll have a chance to interview him and speak with him again in the future. And please reach out to us if you have any thoughts on this episode or any feedback that you would like to share. You can reach us at thehearing@tr.com.
The Hearing, a legal podcast from Thomson Reuters. To find out more, go to tr.com/thehearing or subscribe via iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.